Today we have agreed to assign our topic as the parade of life through geologic time. And tomorrow at this hour, I'm going to spend the hour on local geology, the geology of the immediate area here. And we'll go through it from the beginning that we know in this area, the oldest part of the record, and right on through to the present. So that will be our assignment then for tomorrow. And today we have assigned ourselves quite a task, because this is really a course in historical geology that I'm going to try and present in an hour. Normally this takes a whole semester, and it's a 4-hour credit course. So you're going to hear only the highlights, and this maybe might stimulate you to do some further reading. And in that connection, I would like to give a plug for a book that's here in the store, in the Hike House, that you, I think, would enjoy reading. And if you haven't already read it, buy and read The Immense Journey, The Immense Journey, by Lauren Isley. It's excellent as literature, and it's very, very interesting, and put in an interesting way. This is really the story of evolution again, in another setting. This written by an archaeologist, and gives his perspective of his life's work, and I think you would enjoy reading this very much. Lauren Isley, E-I-S-E-L-E-Y, and it's for sale in the Hike House. Another book that, if you really want to dig deep into this, this was the subject of a reading group here during the summer. Pastor Carol Henderley reviewed it with a group that read it, The Phenomenon of Man, by Tillard de Chardin. He was a Catholic monk, actually, and this book was published after his death. The church would not allow it to be published while he lived. In fact, it wasn't until recent time that this book was allowed to come to light. And it's perhaps one of the great books of our modern time, and I think you would also enjoy reading this. It is the subject of a great deal of study at the present time, and a very provocative account, again, dealing with the parade of life, right up to man and his relationship to God. And I think you would enjoy it. Let me also just mention a few other things that you might find in your own library, or get in your library. This is a lifetime series, Nature Library, and this is well done, and the title is Evolution. And if you want something that is authentic and popularly written, this you would find very interesting and worthwhile, and still deals with the subject in a very comprehensive way from a layman's point of view. Doesn't get too deep into the technology or terminology of the subject matter. If you still want to dig deeper, there are all kinds of things. Here is a book, for example, a $15 book. This life book, incidentally, I think sells for between $3 and $4, and it's well illustrated. This is a $15 book, and of course represents real, authentic interpretation and display of fossils with excellent drawings and so on. And if you're looking for a resource book or a reference book for your library or something in school or church, anywhere, this is a very good one. Well, there are many, many others, and I put out some of them up here. If you happen to live in Illinois or nearby Illinois and are interested in fossils, There are two little books that you can get free if you write for them. And one is the field book, Pennsylvania Plant Fossils of Illinois, and Beginning Fossil Hunter. And these are available simply by writing to the Illinois Geological Survey. And you might look at them here. Animals of the Past by Lucas is in our library here. This is my copy that I've placed here. And it's a book that you could easily get. Very well written and easily understood. Animals of the Past. So on. And every good text, every modern text in historical geology now would give you information along this line that you could consider good and authentic. Now, let's pick up where we left off. Yesterday, we said we had four major spheres. I get my tongue unwrapped here. You need to write them down, I guess. The atmosphere, the hydrosphere, the lithosphere, and the biosphere. We left the biosphere to talk about today. Yesterday we talked about geologic time and the origin of the Earth, the universe, and the things that relate to the inorganic part of the Earth on which we live. Now, let's concentrate today on the story of the organic part, or life as we see it, and follow through on this. Now, we started or finished yesterday with the point of view of time that we would accept as the best date that we know today. The age of the Earth as being about 4.5 billion years old. Now, we want to cover this 4.5 billion years this morning. Now, this, in terms of life, this means that we have to move right along. The the time, geologic time, for convenience, and as it is divided up by the geologist, really gives us a subdivision of about five major chapters or volumes. We might just refer to these as volumes. Let's list them so that we have them down here. The Archaeozoic, the Proterozoic, the Paleozoic, the Mesozoic, and finally the Cenozoic. These are major subdivisions of time based primarily on major changes that have occurred in life. Now, when we get down to this point, we have a major break here, and often this is simply referred to as the Precambrian. So I'll put this in here. P-R-E-C-A-M-B-I-N, Precambrian, and I'll just put it in this way since I've given you the other topics, or the other major divisions. Now let's look at this in terms of time, and set some pegs here, which are placed primarily by the absolute methods of dating that we talked about, the uranium-lead ratio, and other radioactive ways of determining absolute age. Now, the 4.5 billion years of time would be from the bottom here to the top, or the present. Now, this point here is 600 million years before the present. 600 million years before the present. That means that from here down, then, this goes clear to 4.5 billion. To where we start, you see, with the origin of the earth, and come then to this point. Now, the reason we make this break here is because this is the time, geologically, when there was a great radiation and a great great profusion of light that appeared on the earth that became fossil. Now, what do we mean by a fossil? We'll have to define our terms as we go along here, and I'll try and not lose you. If I do, I wave your hand and we'll see if we can't clarify. A fossil is either the actual remains of past life or the trace of past life. Anything that would identify life, you see, in the past. And we emphasize in the past, so that this is something that goes back in the geologic record. Now, a track with three toes, you see, is obviously a fossil. So, tracks and worm burrows, things of this kind that you can identify as being related to organisms, see, then would be a true fossil, if you find it in the rock sequence. And this then, you see, is the basis for the establishing the kind of life that lived in these various periods of time. Now, if we go back to the pre-Cambrian, or the Proterozoic or Archaeozoic, even to what is sometimes referred to as the Azoic, simply A-Z-O-I-C, which means no life, without life. But the record of life earlier than 600 million years is extremely sparse. We have very few fossils from this period back into this period. Now, one of the exciting things that's happened in science within the last 3 or 4 years is that with the aid of some very refined instruments now, the microprobe and the electronic microscope, where we get great magnifications, we have found now some evidences which we think are very good of life in the very primitive stages that goes back as much as 2 billion years. 2 billion years. So you see this. Even at that, this leaves 2.5 billion years ahead of that, where we have absolutely no evidence of life. So for the first 2.5 billion years, we have absolutely nothing. Then from 2 billion years on, we find some very primitive types of things. And these are coming, many of you come from the Minneapolis area and this general area. These are found in your area. In the knife flint series of rocks, which are cherts. And these are cherts that are found in northern Minnesota and up into Canada. And by examining these very fine silica gels that apparently accumulated on ocean bottoms within this area, millions of years ago, in fact, over 2 billion years ago, they have uncovered now fossil evidence within these very, very old rocks. And this is new. Now, for the most part, we have very little in the way of fossils from 2 billion years on up to this 600 million years. What we do find is up in the Canadian Rockies and in the Canadian Shield area, in the younger beds here, in the Proterozoic, and in the bottom of the Grand Canyon, in a few places where these rocks are exposed so that we can study them and collect fossils from them, we have found mainly just algae, algal colonies that have become fossilized and preserved as a part of the record in the limestone. And we find some of these in the Canadian area near Lake Superior and up in this area. So that we have good records, at least of algae. Algae is a plant, of course, a very primitive type of plant. Now, as far as animal life is concerned, within this period, only very simple one-celled forms have ever been found earlier than this period. And so we have only very simple plants, very, very simple animals that we have any record of in this early part of the geologic history of which we're noting here. So, the Precambrian, or the Proterozoic and the Archaeozoic, we can say is pretty devoid of fossils. Now, why is this? Well, one of the reasons is that these rocks, being the oldest rocks, have been subjected to the most movements of the Earth's crust. And the rocks, which were simple rocks at this time, of limestone, shales, and the kinds of soft rocks that you're acquainted with, that normally have fossils in them, have become recrystallized. And everywhere, almost everywhere, where we find these rocks, they're crystalline now. And when the rock recrystallizes, this destroys the evidence of the fossils. And so, for the most part, we lose the fossils simply by the process of recrystallization and the subjection of these rocks to higher temperatures and heat in this recrystallizing process. Another reason we don't know a great deal about this early period is that these rocks are not exposed in very many places, so that there isn't much chance to find fossils. We don't have the same opportunity to collect and work these rocks that we have with the others because they're covered over by the younger rock. And they're only exposed in certain places. In the cores of mountains normally is where we find them. Or in the bottom of a place like the Grand Canyon. Or in the middle of the Appalachians, the middle of the Rocky Mountains, the Canadian Rockies. It's the only place where these rocks have been pushed up enough that we can look at them. In the pushing up process, they're also recrystallized. And this then causes the dirt of fossil information, plus the fact, very likely, that animals and plants at this time had very little in the way of hard parts. It seems that all the material, from the evidence we have, was probably soft parts. And this gets us then to the question, one of the questions we're certainly interested in is, well, what was the first life? What was it like? And how did it originate? Well, let's take first of all, what life like this would be like, the origin of life. The simplest forms that we know today, what would be the simplest? Well, if you trace these back to the simplest forms, we trace the simplest plants back and the simplest animals back to one-cell animals and the simplest plants again to rootless plants, which are very simple. And then finally we come to the point where we get certain kinds of life that we don't know whether they're either plant or animal. That is, we can't distinguish between the two kingdoms of plants and animals. And basically, these are the virus that we now know. As a result of high magnification, we've gotten into the study of virus of various kinds. Now, we have all kinds of diseases and problems that are caused, you know, by the virus. And this is why we are studying it. Now, what is a virus? Well, we don't know whether it's a plant or an animal. Actually, you see, in its dormant stage, when you magnify a virus and look at it, it looks like a mineral. It has the shape of a mineral. And it has structure, which is comparable in many ways to the kinds of things we find in the inorganic world. And it fits with the order of the mineral family, as you see, and this sort of thing. But it is an organic material. It has the ability to reproduce itself and continue its kind of existence. Therefore, we have to call it life. But we don't know. It doesn't have any of the characteristics, really, of a plant or of an animal either. It's just too simple. And you can activate the virus simply by putting it in the right environment where it will propagate and reproduce itself. So when this happens, even within our own body, you see, then we're in trouble. And these things, then we have to get rid of them in order to get rid of what's bothering us. And so we've devoted a lot of study to them. And we know something about them now. But these are even more primitive and more simple than the bacteria and the various kinds of very simple animals that we know. The one cell, the single celled animals, or the single cell plants, which we're sure are plants, or we're sure are animals. See. Now, we divide the two kingdoms from this point on. And we're interested now in following the life sequence of both the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom. Now, let me make this point clear, which I'm sure you probably already know, but let's make sure. All plants are food for animals. No animal can exist without plants. You see, the animal, there is no animal in the animal kingdom capable of taking the inorganic material of rocks and minerals and converting it to life tissue and to the preservation of life of its kind. Think of any animal you know, and it gets its food from plants or from other animals that eat plants. See? So all of the food for the animal kingdom must come from the plants. So the plants have to be first. Then, once you have food, then you can have animals. So we've got to keep this picture coming all the way through from the beginning of life, right on through time. And we'll see that the interplay between these two is very critical, and it's very important, and we always get major advances in the plant kingdom before we can have a major advance in the animal kingdom. This has to precede for food reasons. And this is very important. We all make sure we don't miss this bell when it rings. And we're still a part of this, you see, very much. So as we look at this now, going back, pushing back to where you finally asked me then, well, how did all this get started? And what is the origin of life? Does science have an answer? The answer really is no. We do not know or cannot demonstrate exactly how this happened, exactly why it happened. Now, we think the evidence shows us that in the earliest part of this history, say more than 600 million years ago, in the history of the Earth, the physical history of the Earth, the conditions were such that we had a different kind of atmosphere, probably, than we have today. The atmosphere contained a lot less oxygen than it now does. And the was a kind of an atmosphere where we had a lot more dominance of nitrogen and this kind of thing, and it was a reducing kind of an atmosphere, the kind of which we do not have today. The reason that there is such a prominent break in life at this point and from here on may be related to the change or the evolution of our atmosphere. We talked about the lithosphere, and this is one of the things that we really are still investigating, because it's hard to get good information in this regard. But we have learned that there is a great deal that can be done now with the isotopes of oxygen. Oxygen isn't just O16, you know. We have oxygen 17, we have oxygen 18. And so with the refinements of chemistry and physics, it's now possible to study the content of many of the early fossils and many of the early materials in these fossils now in the earliest part of the record of time. And we're investigating. We really don't have any answers at this point. But we do know that there is a very prominent change here, and that there must be something that explains it, if we can just find out what the answer is. But going back to the real origin of life, the scientists too must accept that life came on Earth as some way other than what he can explain. God created. This is what most scientists, I think, would accept, that it is a creation, but it came about naturally, and not too surprising that within an atmosphere of this kind, that this might have happened. Now, we're interested in researching this area because we're interested to see whether or not we can reproduce from inorganic materials life, you see. Test tube type of life. And this is what you're reading a lot about in the magazines today. A molecule. In other words, bring together chemicals in a molecular structure so that these molecules will reproduce themselves. And you see, like a virus, and so on. And then come on up the scale. Well, this is, of course, the reason for the study is the reason that we're interested in this from the point of view of our own life and medicine, and trying to find out how to control things that cause disease in our own time and in our own environment. So we are studying it, and no doubt the technology is advancing to the point, and science advancing to the point that I think that it's generally predicted that we will be able to create some kind of an organic material in a test tube that maybe has enough of the characteristics of life that you would call it life. Now, where it will go from this point, you see, becomes another problem. But it looks like we are at this point. But as far as geology and paleontology, which is the study of fossils in the past, we can't point to exactly where life started and exactly why it started. We can only give you educated guesses as to the environment and the conditions under which this happened. Now, it didn't have to happen at any one point on the Earth's surface. Probably, if life did evolve in this natural way, in a setting, from the spark of lightning, this is how we produce the amino acids, the basic acids that produce the protein. If you want to do this in the laboratory, you create a big electric spark in an environment that you can create in the laboratory, and we're very close to really creating this kind of thing within the laboratory, which might very well have happened by natural causes at the Earth's surface and could have happened at many different places. And then you had a very primitive type of some kind of life that started. Well, let's say it has started. Let's go on from this point. And I've simply been telling you that I don't know how it started, and I'm willing to accept the fact as we accept it in the inorganic world. We didn't know exactly how the Earth started. We can see and follow the process in various detail, but here again with life we come to the same point. Now let's go on and see what the record shows from this point on. Now, we have very primitive life prior to this time. Say primitive plants, primitive animals, and evidences of very primitive life, of the very basic steps. Now, as we come into the Paleozoic, Paleozoic means ancient life, paleo, ancient, and zoic is life. So this is the area where we have lots of fossils. And here we have millions and millions of fossils of various kinds. So we're not guessing at this point. We have lots of evidence, and this is the subject of paleontology and the, what this $15 book is all about. And you just thumb through it, and you'll see a lot of it here. Well, the Paleozoic starts out then, and what do we find? This is the age, and we'll just put down the major highlights here. Age of marine invertebrates. Age of marine invertebrates. Now, it's important that we emphasize that these are, what an invertebrate is an animal without a backbone. You see, these are the animals that have no backbones. They're the kinds of things that you know as oysters and clams and snails and going through the single-celled animals, the periphera, and so on. But anyway, these are all of the simple kinds of animals that do not have backbones. And this is the age where you find great, or the time when you find great profusion of this kind of evidence in the rocks. These are the kinds of fossils. There are no vertebrate animals at this point, and no fossils of any vertebrates at this point. Now the next, by the time we get to the middle part of the Paleozoic, then we have vertebrates. This is the age of fishes. Why do we call it this? Because in the very, very earliest part of the vertebrate story here, you find that the animal, the very primitive fish at this stage, didn't have a well-pronounced backbone, but just a kind of a rod that extended from the head of the body to the tail, and the soft parts of the body were protected by armored plates, or plates, and the soft part was simply encased. And then it had a kind of a stiffening rod, and it also has a nerve cord that extends from the head back in the direction of the tail. So it achieves its locomotion by this nerve control and by the stiffening of the body with this very primitive type of rod. Well, let's go one step higher in the primitive fishes to one you all know. This is the shark. The shark came in way back in this early period of time and has existed right through to the day. The shark is a very primitive fish. And if you take a look at a shark, notice its tail. And the tail of the shark may be like this, but the backbone comes right up here to the very end of the tail. And it's a very, actually, it's more like this, you see. And that looks more like a shark's tail. Now, a modern fish, the backbone comes right out from here, and then we have a series of fins like this again. This is the way a trout looks. But the shark, is the tail comes clear back here. Another more important thing is that the shark has no bones as such. No calcium carbonate. You see, no stiffening in the bone. It's all cartilage. So you go from a natural transition from soft parts, from muscle to cartilage, and then to bone. And a shark has no bone. The only thing he has that is hard, or harder than cartilage, is the shark's teeth. Now the shark's teeth still are calcium carbonate, but that's the only part of the shark that has any hard part, so that when the shark dies and it tends to disintegrate, and the cartilage of the bones tend to also disintegrate, so that mainly what we get of the record of the shark would be the shark's teeth. And the shark's teeth, as such, have not changed substantially from this period of time clear on through to the present. So the shark is a very interesting animal to us, because it does represent something from the past, where we can follow this through the geologic record, you see. For now, we're actually about 350 million years from the present, by the time we come to this point in geologic time. You see, it has taken 150 million years or more for this to happen from here to here. We had nothing but invertebrates here for millions and millions of years. And then we finally get the primitive fish, and now the fish we can follow through all the way from here clear to modern times, and they make many changes. Now, the next important step that appears in the record is that in younger beds here we have the appearance of amphibians. And we're going to follow mainly the animal story here, and also the vertebrate story, because this is the part that we're most interested in. And the age of amphibians now brings us up the geologic time here, another 50 million years or so, before we get a complete transition from the fish to the amphibian. Well, what's an amphibian like? Well, you all know the frog, and you know that it lives a part of its life cycle in the water, and it must reproduce in the water. It comes out onto the land, but the reproduction takes place within the aqueous environment, and only there. And this is an important step. Now, a major breakthrough comes when the animal can stay out of water completely. Now you see the amphibians. None of the amphibians can get farther away from the body of water in which they were born than what they can get back to it, you see, to lay their eggs and reproduce again. Now, the next step comes here, and this is a very important one. Now, the amniote egg, the egg which carries with it the environment of the sea, really, is the egg, you see, that has a shell, so that the liquid on the inside then is protected and preserved. And in the reptile, the turtle, you know, and any other reptile that's a true reptile, lays an egg. And this egg has a coating. It's either a leathery coating, or in the case of some, it's a hard shell. But anyway, it contains a membrane that keeps the liquid on the inside from escaping. Now, then there is the aqueous environment, you see, where the egg can develop to the young adult, and then when the young adult, or the young one, comes out of the shell, the interesting thing is that all young reptiles look exactly like the full-grown reptile, except in miniature. You just make everything smaller, and a little crocodile or a little turtle looks exactly like a big turtle, except the proportions, you see, it's just bigger, that's all. And here again, we find that nature takes care of the reproduction of its kind by producing a lot of little ones, and there is no attempt made by the parent to take care of the youngsters. They simply find their own way, or they don't, and there are enough of them that live through so that the species continues to live. So we have, when these reptiles hatch out, lots of little reptiles. Most of them will not become big reptiles because they will be eaten up by something else or they don't survive one way or the other. But there's always enough of them that they don't become extinct. So the advent of the egg, the amniote egg, the egg with a shell, where the interior is completely preserved, is the most important thing. And this we find in the record of the rocks, again, as fossils. As soon as you develop something that has a coating or a shell, then you can see, we can find the evidence of it actually as a part of the fossil record. Furthermore, we can also establish this in other ways. That is, on the land areas, you see this, you can tell the difference between saltwater deposits and the freshwater deposits. And on land areas, we find the tracks and other evidences and other things that are fossil related to these, other than just the eggs themselves. The fact that they were able to get away from the salt water completely and from the sea and become a part of the land habitation is a very important thing.